Hello, welcome to the House of Comments. I'm Mark Thompson. I used to be a Lib Dem, but I'm now not. And instead, I just talk about politics from a kind of independent perspective. And I'm joined today by my two co-hosts, Emma Burnell, who's a Labour blogger and activist. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. Good to have you, as usual. And also delighted to be joined, as usual, by Nick Dennis, who is a Conservative activist. Hi, Nick.
Oh, hiya.
Hi. Okay, so the first thing I thought we'd talk about today is a few days ago, MPs voted in overwhelming numbers for anyone who is caught and convicted of a second offence of possession of a knife in a public place will automatically get a 6 month jail sentence. I think some people think it's important to send a message out that knife crime is not acceptable and will be cracked down upon. The vote itself, I think every single Lib Dem MP, or at least every single Lib Dem MP who voted against it, and there were a couple of people from the Conservative and Labour parties who also voted against it, but the vast majority of both Tories and Labour voted for it. Although I think the government ministers on the Tory benches actually abstained because, in a way, that was supposed to kind of indicate some kind of level of solidarity with the Lib Dems, as in the government itself wasn't going to push the line. But the effect is it went through overwhelmingly anyway. What do we think about this? Emma, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think it should be an automatic sentence for of 6 months for a second offence of possession of a knife?
I worry about automatic sentences in general. I think that there is a better ways of doing things than just going. I mean, I just, I look at the California three strikes you're out rule. Obviously, this is different to that, but it's the same sort of slippery slope. And I do worry about. I mean, automatic minimums for certain crimes. Yes, of course, that makes sense. But automatic sentences for doing the same crime twice. Just I don't know. It's something about it makes me feel very uncomfortable. I am obviously on the liberal end of the Labour Party. The Labour Party is not in itself a specifically liberal party. There are liberals and there are authoritarians. That's always been the case. It's not what we come together collectively to believe in. But for me, this is. I just, it makes my skin crawl a little bit. I'm just a bit uncomfortable. I think it's the wrong way with the problems that we have around knife crime.
Nick, what do you think about this?
On Saturday, I was in a local park with 15 others, and out of the 15 of us, seven of us had 7-inch blades.
Right.
Now, what we were doing is we were scything. I don't know if you've ever done scything. It's a fantastic hypnotic way of cutting grass, and it's more environmentally friendly than other ways of doing it. So it's so there's sort of a movement to try and bring back eco-friendly ways. So I was helping out a local park group in my area, and it was really good fun. But in many ways, could I have been arrested for possession of a knife? I mean, or the problem I have with this legislation is it seems to be doesn't seem to it seems to be pretty indiscriminate in sort of the way it's framed. But actually, in reality, what it is it's targeting the people who get angry, who get targeted by stop and search. So, for instance, at the weekend, it was me and 15 mainly retired people, not retired people with wielding 7-inch blades in a local park. But police are never going to stop us and tell us off or arrest us. But if you know if somebody a young black guy in Hackney who's a chef who's walking down the street has a knife for work, he's more likely to get stopped and found and arrested. And so I think this is, the sentiment behind the law is probably the right one in a way, but it smacks as lawmaking of the worst possible type, which is a good headline, but in practice and reality has danger of leading to bad outcomes.
My problem with this, you won't be surprised to hear that I'm not in favour of this. Despite the fact I'm not a Lib Dem anymore, I'm definitely a fellow traveller on these sort of issues with them. And I'm very pleased that they voted against it, even though, that'll probably be used against them in leaflets in the run-up to the next election. But I think it was the right thing to do because I do think that judges should be left with the discretion to be able to decide. Yeah, I don't think that MPs voting, in June 2014 can know all circumstances in years to come where people might be arrested for possession of a knife. They just can't know all the extenuating or, you know, specific circumstances. And, you know, this is why we have judges and why we have a judicial process, in order to, you know, to be able to decide these things. And it's very worrying that MPs feel they can just trample all over that and just arbitrarily say, no, 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 under all and any circumstances, if someone's, you know, convicted of this crime under these circumstances, then this is what happens. And it's like, that just feels totally wrong to me. And I think it is. I mean, I'm not a big fan of slippery slope arguments, but I think this is a slippery slope, because this is the sort of thing now. I mean, it's not just like, you know, there was a hard fought debate about it in the Commons and then it was a knife edge vote. It wasn't. It was overwhelming. And it's the same sort of thing we've seen in the past with like votes for prisoners and, you know, other things like this. It's like the Commons as a whole is very, very authoritarian on issues like this. And I can't see that getting any better. I think any time a backbencher has an idea of something that they can crack down on, it seems very likely to me that, you know, the Commons, not even on a kind of on a whipped vote from the government, just the Commons in general, will vote for these things.
So I haven't been following it that closely, but I know it was Nick Dubois who put in a private members bill. But I'm assuming it hasn't gone to the Lords yet.
I don't think it has gone to the Lords.
Because the Lords, I don't know, the Lords is the type of place that might try and sort this out. I mean, firstly, they don't have to worry about voters, for better or for worse. They don't have to worry about the Daily Mail headlines. But also, secondly, in the Lords, you have a lot of people who have experience of actually dealing with the law and with the court system, who might make some, you know, might make some reasonable points. Because, I mean, at a basic level, I mean, what happens if I enjoy, you know, making steak or whatever, and I want to cut my roast or whatever, and so I buy a knife and I bring it home. You know, how am I going to get my knife home?
That I well, bought in the yeah, shop? I mean, I think it's not. I slightly made a mistake early this week when I tweeted and complaining about this, and I complained that they've made it into a strict liability offence. Actually, that's wrong. It's not a strict liability offence. Someone corrected me on that. I mean, they were right when I looked into it a bit more. So it's not like they're saying that if you're caught with a knife, that's it, 6 months. What they're saying is if you're caught and convicted for possession, and I guess there must be some kind of judicial process that he's gone through, and circumstances like I was carrying it because I'm a chef, you'd probably be fine.
But if you're carrying it and you're wearing a hoodie, not.
Well,
this is the problem I have with this type
absolutely.
Of thing.
I mean, that comes back to the whole question of, you know, context and you know, exactly like you said. I mean, you know, I don't know how many more times likely a black person is to be stopped than a white person, but I know it's several. And therefore, it just issues like, I mean, it's exactly the same with drugs laws, isn't it? You know, black people are more likely to be caught in possession of drugs, even though they don't take them any more than white people. It's the same sort of thing. And I don't think you ever really, well, I hesitate to use the word ever, because hopefully at some point we will. But at the moment, that's definitely the case. And so therefore, it's going to disproportionately affect certain, you know, certain groups in this country. But Emma.
Yes.
You're still with us. Good.
I am.
I forgot to say at the start, actually, that you're on a dodgy iPad, so you could disappear from us forever.
I could, yeah. But I hopefully won't. Okay. In fact, I could fire up the laptop, so I've got that standing by.
Well, maybe we'll do that if necessary. But you did drop out a little bit earlier on. I mean, did you want to expand on the answer that you gave? Because obviously it sounds like you're uncomfortable with this. But I mean, are you worried about how authoritarian the Commons can be on issues?
I'm not like you. It's not what keeps me up at night. I think there are things I'm more worried about in the world than whether Parliament is overly authoritarian. I think there are real tensions between what people want to do and liberalism, which are quite, quite different. And, you know, the Parliament is there to represent the will of the people. And unfortunately, the will of the people is often quite authoritarian. And, you know, so I think there are real problems with saying it is wrong to be authoritarian whilst in a representative democracy.
Okay, but as an example in this case,
the Home Affairs... this case, I think it's wrong. Yeah, but I take each issue on as it comes, rather than having a natural "I will always oppose," "I will always support."
Okay, that's fine. But in this particular case, there was a Home Affairs Select Committee reported on this exact issue a few years ago. They looked into it, they took evidence, they really, really thought about it. And there was a unanimous report that they issued that said that this shouldn't be made a mandatory 6-month sentence under these precise circumstances. And they had, you know, very good arguments and reasons as to why. And that's obviously a cross-party committee. And that just gets completely ignored. when it comes to the floor of the House. And that's the sort of thing that worries me, because, you know, I'm kind of in favour of kind of evidence-based policy. And I think, you know, if people go away and do a lot of work and a lot of careful thinking about this stuff and look at the evidence and think, you know, is this generally going to be better? Is it going to actually do what we think it's going to do and what we hope it will do, i.e. reduce knife crime? And, you know, it just doesn't seem to work like that. It kind of feels like something's broken somewhere. I know you might think I'm saying this just because, you know, a pet issue of mine has kind of, you know, been overwhelmingly rejected, but it's kind of a bit deeper than that.
Well, I mean, there are problems with democracy. That's always been the case. The democracy is the worst system except for all the others. You know, it is, these are the tensions that exist within democracy. And, you know, broken is one way of putting it. But, you know, it's easy to say when it's your pet issue. And, you know, I would say the same thing about the bedroom tax, for example. There's massive evidence before the bedroom tax was brought in as to exactly the kind of hardship that it was going to bring up, and that it wouldn't do the very thing that it was promoted to be doing. That wasn't, but it was the will of government who were elected by the people, well, mostly. And, you know, that was how that worked. So I think, as I say, it's just tensions between what we would all do in an ideal world, which is different for every single one of us, and what happens under a democratic system.
Actually, interesting you say about bedroom tax, because that sort of brings us on to the next thing that we were going to talk about, which I even hesitate to introduce, because before we started recording, when I mentioned how I was going to introduce it, you instantly took umbrage, Emma. So do you want to introduce this topic instead and explain what you think Labour are talking about in terms of welfare and potential cuts?
Well, it's not just welfare. That's part of the problem. What's happened is that the IPPR, a very well-respected think tank.
Institute for Public Policy Research.
Yeah.
Which is Labour-aligned.
Well, it's cross-party-ish, but it's been traditionally Labour working.
It's cross-party for tax purposes.
They have
like many non-aligned think tanks.
They have, I mean, as far as I understand it, they have worked with Conservatives, Liberal Democrats, but they are traditionally, you know, they were set up with the Blair Project in mind, worked very closely with the last Labour government. And they are a, you know, their thinking is it tends to be left of centre. But what they've done is produce a very long, detailed, interesting report called The Condition of Britain. And it's looking at how social democracy would work under a different type of system. So for the last sort of 30 years post Thatcher, you know, Thatcher, since the Thatcherite consensus, social democracy has worked by not interfering with the market, but then trying to make reparations to the losers after they have lost. So things like tax credits, things like welfare, things like minimum wage, etc., etc. Actually, minimum wage was sort of meddling in the market, but that was an unusual step for the Blair government. Mostly what it was about was trying to say, well, we've got the proceeds of rampant capitalism and we'll redistribute them in a different way. We'll put them into health, we'll put them into education, we'll put them into child tax credits, we'll put them into working tax credit, all that sort of thing. Obviously, since the crash, the question has been, well, there will be times when there is no money to make those reparations. There are, you know, we are not, again, this is part of this democracy issue. There is not a democratic will to move to a system of very, very high tax takes. We're not going to become a Swedish style social democracy. So what do we do instead? What does social democracy do that it can intervene in such a way that it's not simply about coming in at the end and trying to make reparations to those who've lost out under rampant capitalism? How does it instead make capitalism work better for in and of itself? How does it work, make a better system? So the report covers lots and lots and lots of different areas, some of which Labour have said, yes, that's a good idea, we will look into doing that. And the one that people have been quite exercised about is the idea that we will, if you are between 18 and 21 and don't have A-level or equivalent, then you don't have the automatic right to job seekers. You wouldn't have the automatic right to job seekers allowance. What you would have to have is funding whilst training, and you would have to be training in order to get yourself job ready, in order to get yourself ready for a good job. At the same time, those who are currently in FE will now be entitled for the first time to financial support. So it means that people are much, much more able to train. And it's about, again, it's about intervening early, you know, when people are just sort of coming out of the school system, saying, you know, have you yet got the right skills for the jobs market? Are you yet able to, instead of just getting into that cycle of insecure job dole, actually getting skilled up so that you can actually go up the career ladder. It's a change in attitude. It's a way of changing the DWP's attitude in particular, which under Labour, as much as under anyone else, was about get a job, get any job, the career ladder will kick in. And we just know that's not the case anymore. So it's about looking at how we make that happen rather than assuming that it's happening, which it hasn't done for probably 20, 25 years.
Sounds fair enough. Nick, what do you think?
I think the best way to make it happen would be to get rid of Ed Miliband as leader. Because I just don't think that he's able to communicate ideas in a clear way that people find attractive. And I think, you know, very interesting explanation of this report, Emma, which I think does sound very interesting. And actually, you know, I think it's a long and interesting way of looking at this. But I mean, what a leader should do, or what a political party should be able to do with work like this that think tanks do, is be able to translate it into a way that clearly explains what they're about. And I think part of the problem here with this issue is that Ed Miliband is completely incapable of explaining actually what he's about in language that people understand. So you get confusion, you get mistakes, and we end up in this situation where you know, he's thought to have said one thing and different people shouting, but apparently he's not said that. And then people get confused and think, well, actually, has he said anything at all?
Well, I think there's a couple of issues with that. First of all, we would not be having these interesting and deep conversations without Ed Miliband as leader. If we'd had another leader, we would not have been trying to change philosophically as much as that we are. There would not be the kind of work being undertaken. So, you know, the idea that this could have been done by another leader is frankly a nonsense. And the other thing is that there are people who, on both left and right, will always shout at Ed Miliband for anything he says. And there are people, particularly on the left, who cannot hear of any change to the welfare system proposed by anyone without assuming it's an attack on welfare and it's an attack on scroungers and that's, you know, what we're doing. And they don't hear anything else. They never will. They can't. They're incapable of it. And so they will always do that shouting, and that shouting will always happen. But actually, at the end of the day, what we've got is a sensible leader with a sensible system and a sensible idea. And what we're not going to do, because although we are a bit mad in the Labour Party, we're not mad enough to tear ourselves to pieces in the leadership contest less than a year before a general election.
It'd be entertaining, though.
I'm sure you'd love it, but frankly, no, fuck off.
Well, it would be entertaining, but actually, from a Conservative perspective, it's beneficial if Ed Miliband stays, because I think I think people don't really understand what he's about. I know people think that he's a deep thinker, maybe, but they probably think he is. But really, it's as clear as mud what he wants Britain to be. All right. What's New Labour to be? Or not when I say New Labour, I mean the current Labour Party, of course.
I think if we could just maybe just try and dig a little bit deeper into the potential ramifications of this sort of approach, though, Emma, because I think one of the things that would worry me about this sort of approach is that it sounds like in an ideal world, it would be a really, really good way to restructure the benefit system and the welfare system and our whole approach to this whole issue. Isn't the problem, though, that any kind of major overhaul like this is very, very difficult? I mean, we're seeing it with universal credit, which I know in principle a lot of people on the left agree with. But when you actually try and implement something like that, I mean, I think it's really looking now like universal credit is dead. And I think it was even reported today.
Universal credit's always been dead. It just has been wandering around like a zombie.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But so the point is that universal credit in itself isn't necessarily a bad idea. It's just trying to turn around the super tanker that is, you know, Whitehall and the British state and how these things operate is nigh on impossible in any kind of reasonable time frame. So therefore, what is more likely to happen.
This is half a universal credit. It's not reliant on some giant IT system.
No,
it's
of course.
It's one small change to the benefit system.
No, but it is.
We can't even do that. We should all pack up and go home.
But it is reliant upon thousands and thousands of civil servants to, you know, push through a change in the way things are done. So isn't it more likely that what would happen is that the sort of things we're seeing in the headlines...
Any benefit change.
Yeah, but isn't it more likely that what we'd see is that the sort of things we're seeing in the headlines, like, you know, that's being interpreted as Labour being tough on welfare and, you know, and effectively cuts to youth benefits. That is the sort of effect that we could see, because the kind of restructuring that you're talking about and the new approach would be difficult to get through. But the kind of the effects that it would have would be that people between 18 and 21 wouldn't be able to claim job seekers allowance. But maybe the infrastructure that's required in order to get them the training won't be in place or won't be good enough. And people actually will, you know, suffer as a result of this, young people.
Well, that's all been set out in the report as to how that's done. I mean, it's all there in the IPPR report. This is not something that have gone, oh, let's snatch that off the shelf. This is something that the IPPR have spent a year, 2 years thinking about, making sure that they've got this backed up with evidence.
So if the IPPR was actually...
evidence-based policy, Mark.
Yeah,
so you should love it.
Yeah, so if the I like the sound of it, but if the IPPR were implementing it, maybe it would happen. The problem is, who's going to implement it is a government.
So what you're saying is we should never, ever do anything ever because we can't do one thing. Are you saying that nothing this government has done has happened?
Well, this government or a
any government. Has government never done anything?
I think government tries to do more than it is capable of doing. I think that's definitely true.
So we shouldn't do anything at all?
No. I'm slightly playing devil's advocate. I really hope that this does work, and I think it would be a good thing if it did. My fear is that, you know, high-minded plans often don't work out the way you would hope.
But this is a costed, fairly small, fairly specific programme of work. It's quite different from Universal Credit, which was a pipe dream.
Oh, well, can I just jump in again? Because I want to drag it a little bit back to the process. And the reason why is because I think generally it's quite a good idea. And, but I think what's most interesting about this is how it's, you know, how it has been treated by the media, for instance, where they do like to box everything into this sort of, this view is because Labour are now against welfare, you know, cracking down on welfare. It has to be one or the other. And I think, you know, it's just, you know, the way politics and political arguments are reported in this country, do a disservice to them a lot of time. And you know, the journalists should be interested in actually finding out what's in this report and actually reporting it more intelligently, even if there are, you know, changes in Labour policy or what it's moving towards. One of the a research project that I worked on recently was, you know, Generation Y, what they believe and all this sort of stuff. So, you know, I had my head in that for quite a long time. And then over the last couple of weeks, I've seen a load of articles with people by people saying, oh, well, young people are more conservative than they used to be, which is completely rubbish, because the whole point when you look into Generation Y and young people is that you can't judge them within our current structures of how politics works, because they don't put themselves in those structures. But that's too complicated for journalists to communicate. So what they do is they try and place what's happening within their own sort of thought structure. And then essentially other journalists agree with this being placed within their own thought structure. And it sort of rolls on into this place where it has no connection with the original, if you look at the original evidence of what's happening. But, you know, that's the way it is, unfortunately. I don't know what we can do to stop it, really.
Not taking it so seriously. I mean, they are completely pointless. Most 9 out of 10 political stories are just like, yeah, whatevs.
Yeah, really. Well, there's an interesting theory about the growth in political news, which is basically that it's free, which is one of the reasons why we tend to have more and more political news in this sort of way, because it's one of those areas where journalists can get stories for free rather than, you know, proper paying journalists to go undercover and do proper deep investigative journalism.
It gets me on the radio.
And you're fantastic, Mark. You do your best.
Oh, thank you very much.
I have to say, not that I've listened to you on the radio, because...
I'll send you some clips, Nick.
Well, yeah, I'll park that for the winter. Because I tend not to listen to too much. The only thing I actually listen to is Any Questions. I think it's very good. But apart from that, the rest of the radio coverage, I don't, you know, it's very soundbitey. But you know, anyway. So anyway, so that's my sort of you know, the general principle of what's being proposed is very good. And I think there is this bigger issue at the moment. There is this massive issue at the moment, which is that people want the state to enforce justice, but they're nervous about the state doing it in the traditional way, such as, you know, super high taxes on the super rich, or even wonder if that's possible. So I think both, you know, certain groups on the centre-right and certainly certain groups on the centre-left are trying to sort of, how can we deal with the unfairness in this globalised world? And also, you're right, Emma, in this where people are sort of nervous about taxing too much. And I think that is a really interesting... you know, there's a really interesting conversation going on there.
Well, just before we move on from this, maybe into the last few minutes, I mean, this story sort of links with another story that's been going on in the last few days, which is that it's being reported now, kind of, I think officially, I'm not sure of the exact context of this, but basically the whole kind of reform of benefits for disabled people is now being widely recognised as having failed, effectively. I mean, the fact that you've got disabled people waiting 9 months or longer for the decision about whether or not they're going to get the equivalent of whatever the replacement for disability living allowance is now, you know, is frankly shocking. And the government's response to it seemed terribly complacent to me, which is that, yeah, there have been a few issues, but yeah, we're on top of it, and don't worry, we'll get it sorted. What about all the disabled people who were having to live on very little, if no money? I mean, it struck me that if this was structured in such a way as unless and until the decision is made, people get full benefits, this would have been sorted years ago, because then the government would have had a financial incentive to get it sorted. Instead, at the moment, the incentives are completely the wrong way around. The longer they take, the more money they save off the backs of some of the poorest and most disadvantaged people in the country. I mean, I'll come to you first, Emma. I'm guessing you're not going to disagree with a single word I've said there, but... I mean, do you think governments in general, and this government in particular, are going to learn from this?
I would hope so. I think there have been when this government first started, one of the things that you heard quite a lot was that they'd really learned from Tony Blair's book to go as quickly as possible at the beginning of a government to get as much done. If you were going to have a revolution, you had to have it in the first 18 months. And I think that speed has been part of what has caused so many of these problems. You know, we see it probably at its harshest end in the DWP, but we're also hearing about all the difficulties in the Department for Education. You know, the NHS is struggling and will continue to struggle with the changes that were made there. And I think that revolutionary fervour that the government started off with, which they, you know, they're now in revolutionary torpor, as far as I can tell, I think was a mistake. I think, okay, maybe they learned a lesson too far. They took the learning of that lesson and took it beyond where it should have gone.
Nick, what do you think?
I mean, this is one of those issues that when I've come across people who've had personal dealings with this issue, either themselves or family members, you know, the anger is real. It's not political. It's not, you know, it's not a game. There is, you know, there is real anger about what's going on. But I mean, unfortunately, in terms of the bigger picture, I suppose not enough people do have direct contact with this issue. So whether it, you know, there'll be national pressure on politicians to do something in the same way as there is, you know, on the Daily Mail knife crime thing is another matter. But I mean, one of the biggest mistakes this government made at the beginning, and sort of, you know, I'm agreeing with Emma's point here, is they wanted to reduce the cost of, you know, borrowing and how the state was run, but also at the same time there was this idea which was called Big Society. Do we remember Big Society, everyone? Well,
yeah,
but the Big Society is a rubbish name for a great idea, and obviously not an original idea, but, you know, a great idea which was worth promoting. And the idea of that would be to sort of, you know, basically open up how services were delivered, make them delivered on the local level, and you know, allow charities to you know, to sort of take different certain parts of things and groups to form and all this type of stuff, and it would be transparent, it would be local. But what happened was that the civil service had great difficulty in trying to make this work for whatever reason. So what they did is they basically went ahead with the cuts before sorting out how actually, shall we say, more innovative ways of delivering public services could happen. So you had the you know these things needed to happen at the same time in order to try and make them work. But the problem was that they couldn't do that. And this is why we left in this situation here where, you know, the imperative to cut money, bang, straight away, there it is, and people are doing it. But how we actually do this, people haven't been able to figure out how to do it or how to do it in new different ways. So, you know, in the end, they just sort of try and work in the same old, you know, bigger ways, which aren't really connected to people's experiences on the real ground. And so that for me, that's probably the biggest disappointment of this government.
Yeah. And it's in a strange way because the government imposed this cap on welfare, this kind of self-imposed cap. I think it was 119.5 billion or something like that. And I think they're going to bust their own rules because they've not been able to get a grip on things as much as they wanted to. And I mean,
well, they obviously read Brown's book as well, then, as well as Tony Blair's.
Yeah, yeah.
And their own rules.
It kind of just feels a bit sort of depressing to me. I don't really want to finish on such a downbeat note, but I think that is where we're going to end it today. The reason I didn't want to end it on such a downbeat note is because this is the last podcast that we're going to do with all three of us as co-hosts, because both Nick and Emma are going to move on to other things. I'll let them both explain why they're abandoning me. Nick, do you want to explain first?
Yes, I mean, the whole reason I joined a House of Commons podcast was because I wanted to make Mark a Conservative. So phase one was to get him to leave the Liberal Democrat Party, and phase two was to make him more Conservative, and I think basically I've achieved that.
But I think it was also because congratulations, okay, in yes. order, because you yeah. You actually have been elected as a councillor, haven't you, Nick?
Yes, I have. I know the real reason, but hopefully that secondary reason will happen, but unlikely. But the real reason is that I was recently elected as local councillor, which is, you know, it's turning out to be a fantastic experience, but it is a lifestyle choice. And I mean, anybody who's thinking about becoming a local councillor, I would definitely, you know, so far I've only been doing it for 3 weeks, but definitely push that person to doing it. But, you know, there are a lot of things that, you know, a lot of things you need to do. And because I've been elected, I just feel like I have to do them well and give up my time for them. And I mean, also, as an aside, a very important aside, my wife's pregnant with our first child, so which will, you know, in the autumn, the first child will arrive in the autumn, and putting those two things together means I'm just going to have to cut out a lot of other things, unfortunately.
It's fair enough. I think they're both completely valid excuses, so yeah. I will let you off.
Thank you, Mark.
Emma, do you have as good excuses as Nick there?
Well, I'm not pregnant, I'll tell you that much for nothing. Basically, there was a couple of things. Firstly, my job has got exponentially busy, and it's just, you know, taking up my entire life, and I'm not writing as much as I'd like to, and that obviously is my first love.
Yeah.
So I need to... One of the things I've tried to learn in lots of different areas of my life recently is to get better at saying no and to do a few things well rather than lots of things not so well. And I started to feel like I wasn't doing this as well as I could be. And also, you know, I alluded to this earlier, the government aren't doing that much at the moment. And I've started to feel like I'm repeating myself on the podcast too often. And, I don't think I'm offering quality that I could be and should be.
It's funny you should say that, Emma, because actually I'm feeling the same way about my writing. A few times in the last few weeks I've sat down to write something and I've thought, I've written this before. And it's like I think I've done so many blog posts that I am essentially just repeating myself now. So I'm not quite sure what the answer is to that. Maybe we need a new government and a new set of
I'm in favour of that.
But on a serious point, though, I would like to thank both of you for all the time and effort that you've put into this podcast. I mean, I asked you both to be co-hosts, I know, at different points. So obviously, Emma, you've been doing this with me for 18 months plus now, very regularly on, you know, most podcasts. In fact, it was the two of us for a very long time. And then
indeed,
we kind of revised it the start of the year and kind of did the cycle thing. And that's when you joined us, Nick. pandemic. But yeah, I think you've both been brilliant. I asked you both on because, you know, I really enjoyed, you know, your writing. And Nick, we had you on as a guest a few times and I thought you were very good. So thank you. Thank you very, very much for everything that you've contributed.
Well, thank you for asking me.
No problem.
And it has been a great pleasure. And I've got to speak to many interesting people. And basically, this has just felt like a, you know, always like a nice friendly chat among mates, which I've really enjoyed.
Yeah. That's sort of always been the idea. And also, Nick, thank you for kind of bringing the extra ideas and breadth. I mean, you did things like interviews with people and, you know, and kind of slightly shook up the format as well. And it kind of made me think that maybe I should be doing that sort of thing a bit more. And just to kind of draw it to a close. So obviously you're both going to go off and do other things. My personal circumstances are such, I mean, me and my wife had a baby a couple of months ago. He's actually crying in the background, although I don't think you can quite pick it up on the microphone. And also we're going to be moving house and I've got stuff going on with my job as well. So I am going to carry on doing the podcast, but I am going to take a break for an indeterminate length of time. I may come back with the odd special. So I was thinking I might try and do something close to the time of the Scottish referendum. And I may, if I get the opportunity to speak to and interview interesting people over the next few months, perhaps record them and release them as special episodes. But probably there'll be a break of a few months. Certainly in the run up to the next general election, I intend to start podcasting regularly again and have guests on. And I would like to have both of you back on as guests.
Happily.
At points.
Pleasure.
Which would be great. But yeah, we'll have a little break for a while. So thank you very much again to both of you and all, to all our guests we've had on over the last 18 months since we rebooted and restarted. It's been great. And I'd also like to obviously thank Audio Boo, who hosts the podcast, and Kevin McLeod at incompitech.com for our theme music. And like I say, we will be back at some point. So keep yourself subscribed.